Fall is all about cozy comforts, but when you're prioritizing your health, it's easy to feel like you're missing out. With Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your fall favorites because they're made with Hero Bread sliced bread loaves, tortillas, bagels, dinner rolls, and more. Try their all-new Hero Noodles with 12 grams of protein and just 80 calories. You won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. They've even got small batch drops of indulgent favorites like the popular Hero Croissant. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at HERO.co. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Delivering on the returns, increasing our margins.
Ratings go down the toilet if I'm not here.
All I do is simply put the math in my favor.
We agree that Brandon and John do good work.
The reason is simple wrestling economics.
I've been told the Netflix numbers. I've been told the metrics a little bit, probably 5 different times. I still don't get it.
There were respectable wrestling journalists who needed answers.
Thank you very much, members of the media. I hope you all go to hell.
How about we pop a number right here, right now?
Whole part of the show, man.
And we are back, everybody. It is John Pollock and Brandon Thurston, joined by many charts on today's show. Yes. Get ready, folks. It's gonna be a banger. We are here after a week off. We had to recharge, but we're back. Mm-hmm. We're bringing
it's been an especially, this is a great thing to say at the beginning of a podcast, right? It's been an especially slow news couple weeks.
A little bit. Yeah. It's picking up a bit this week. I was saying to myself last week, you know what? The UFC could use like a betting scandal. I think that would be necessary. I think Paul could do some kind of panel chat. Could get some earnings calls coming.
Mm-hmm.
All things that will be discussed. And of course, it's Hall of Fame season. Do you have your sticker, Brandon? Did you vote?
I've not voted in the Hall of Fame yet.
Oh.
But I understand votes are due by what, this weekend sometime?
Yeah. I mean, CNN was giving The Observer wall-to-wall coverage last night.
Right. Not all the votes are in yet, though. So
yeah.
we can't call any races yet.
Who's the Zoran Mamdani of this year's Hall of Fame class?
Someone who's going to actually win, but I think the who are the likeliest candidates to win are Cody. I'm a very stingy voter, and I get the sense that's way off from the norm. So I just, you know. There are going to be candidates who go in because I think the voters in general, they want to vote liberally. No politics connotations meant there. But somebody's going to go in and you consider, well, I guess we'll get into it. But there were candidates who were close last time. And I think those are the ones who are most likely to go in.
Yeah. I hope we get to a point where some of these figures, they'll openly have to campaign in the future. Wouldn't that be fun? We had a campaign season. You had to have like the descendants of Ole Anderson going on podcast to advocate for the late Ole. That'd be something.
I remember when he advocated for his own candidacy on Observer Live in 2003, was it?
Very famous show when his book came out. And he
aren't you the one who put me in the Hall of Fame?
It was a wonderful show of just.
I listened to it live. I was spellbound. Like, oh my
live.
God! Ole Anderson is yelling at Dave Meltzer right now. It's quite a moment.
Oh, I would to live in an era where Ole was putting out his book and then opting to do media. I don't know if he did one other interview to promote that book, but what a you pick your spots and you chose an outlet that the interview far outlasted memories of his book. Inside.
Hulk Hogan never drew a dime and Ric Flair never did either. There are many quotes from that interview that will, stay in my mind forever.
Yeah.
You're telling me facts that I'm not aware of. Another one.
Well, there's the man laid out his campaign for you right then and there, as he is on the ballot this year. We will see if he's going to go in. So Brandon and I are going to go over our ballots. And then a little later on, we will be talking about Paul Levesque. Joining the All In podcast crew.
Paul Levesque's at All In?
Paul Levesque was all in last week, and we got 26 minutes of Paul Levesque. And I mine this with a fine tooth comb, Brandon. I don't think I had one. This is what we do.
No, I don't think there was either.
Unfortunate. Yeah. Maybe he's aware of what the internet was stating about his crutch phrase. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about, some market to market comparisons. And Brandon has broken down now that we're over a month into the big data plus panel era. Everyone wants to name this boom period. Well, maybe this will be the softening of it. Brandon is going to give us a contrast. What wrestling programs are getting hit the worst? And here's the spoiler. All wrestling shows have been hurt by this new methodology, but which ones are taking it the worst? Mm-hmm. Some all-time lows over the weekend. The World Series destroying pro wrestling, Brandon.
SmackDown did under 1 million viewers.
Uh-oh. A million viewers. I was told that AEW can't hit a million viewers. That was always the talking point. Is this the end of SmackDown?
It's a great opportunity to tweet some things. It is, and to get some engagement. No yes. million?
Yeah. I guess it plummeted in the cable rankings, right?
No, it was number one on
what?
In the demo still, despite being under a million viewers.
What? There was a breakdown of the Canadian audience for Game 7. I think the game averaged like 14 million viewers in Canada, which is astounding. But then, you know, Rogers is breaking down this to just as high a number as possible they can get to. And the number of people that sampled a portion of the game was over 18 million, meaning almost half the country tuned in at some point to watch this game on Saturday night.
I watched it too. I was putting my hands on my head at various points.
Yes, this was the image that Brandon sent to me. This was all 18 million of us on Saturday
night. Who's this? This is
Treya Savage, our 22-year-old phenom.
Yes, he's your young star pitcher. And then we have, who's the manager?
This is John Schneider.
This is the moment when the World Series game had just ended. And he was in this position, leaning over, his arms crossed over the dugout for, you know, throughout the game. This was his position to observe the game and monitor it. And when the game ended in extra innings, he did not move a muscle. He just stared into space with his arms still crossed.
Yeah. To be fair, this is also the one and only expression that Brandon and I share when we're attending wrestling shows.
Yes. I'll usually be watching a basketball game on my laptop.
that's true. Brandon is usually enjoying the second screen experience in person, as yes. I can attest to. Let's get into the Observer Hall of Fame ballot. Brandon, how long have you been voting in the Observer Hall of Fame? Long time? Short time?
I think you've asked me this before.
Probably
2015 or so.
So about a decade.
I'd have to look in my email. Yeah.
Okay. When you were you first addressed as Brandon Howard or Brandon Thurston?
I don't know. Yeah.
And do you remember what the email was that Dave responded to from years prior that included your ballot on it?
My email address or his?
No, the specific email that was a reply to a previous email.
So this is one of the benefits of achieving Hall of Fame voter status is that he doesn't necessarily send you a new email. I wouldn't know. I didn't actually get the email, but you procured one for me this year. But he will, at least in previous years, he will find one of your previous email correspondents and reply to that. As opposed to sending you a brand new email with a subject line that says Hall of Fame ballot, he'll just reply to the last email that you said and give you your ballot that way.
Yes.
Whatever works for you.
You know what? The compose option in your email is overrated as opposed to a reply. So, I have been voting for quite some time, a little longer than Brandon. So we're mainly going to focus. I just did a show on the Post Wrestling Cafe going through my ballot, and I will go through all the people I am voting for this year. But Brandon, what categories are you voting in this year?
I'm voting, I think we're going to center our discussion today, mainly on the U.S. modern. This is the most narrow I've ever voted before. As people know, there are various categories.
I hope people are watching this. This is Brandon's finest.
These are the results from last year. Just give everybody an idea of where we're at. There are a few candidates on the ballot this year who are not last year. But I'm going to only vote in the U.S. modern. That's the the category that I'm most comfortable with. I have voted in almost all. I don't think I've ever voted in the Pacific European mm-hmm. category before, but I voted in all the other categories various times. So I'm going to vote only in the US modern. Leave the historical. And as we get older here, the historical, I think, you know, it has assumed candidates like Junkyard Dog and so forth, who, you know, I feel there are others who are much more qualified than me, to vote for those other categories. In any case, this year, let's say last year, the candidates who are no longer on the ballot because they were inducted are Roman Reigns, who got 67%, got 2/3. You have to get 60% to be inducted in this non-physical, only on paper Hall of Fame. But Roman Reigns, Paul Orndorff, and the Young Bucks all went in from this category. Yes, Asuka, Bray Wyatt, Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn, Sid, and the Usos.
Sid Udy.
Were on the ballot last year, got less than 10%, so they were dropped. And the rest remain. Also being added this year are who? Drew McIntyre, Mercedes Moné / Sasha Banks, FTR, Bill Dundee, I'm sure has been on the ballot before, but was not on the ballot last year.
Yeah, he is in the modern category, although I think he's moving to the historical category potentially next year.
He's on the modern. Eh.
I think it's taking into account, yeah, he's a weird one when we are assessing him next to Drew McIntyre, for instance. But I believe he's moving to historical next year, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, as Brandon mentioned, yeah, Drew is on this year. I don't see Drew getting any kind of support this year. Mercedes Moné is, you know, there's going to be a lot of comparisons with her and Becky Lynch. Becky, I think, has gotten like nominal support. How did she do last year? As we look here, 25%. So she has a lot of ground to make up. I'll just throw out mine that I am voting for, and then I'll hand it over to Brandon with his. I'm voting for the Briscoes as I did last year. I'm also voting for John Moxley again. I'm voting for CM Punk again. I'm voting for Cody Rhodes again. And I am adding Sabu this year. He passed away earlier this year. A lot of cases have been made for Sabu. I'm not as high as others are on Sabu. He reached my threshold this year. It's a 6 maximum. So I'm voting for 5. I'm not maxing out my ballot in this category, but I think Punk and Rhodes would be the two big favorites this year that I would be somewhat surprised, especially Cody, but Punk for that matter too. I think it's going to be those two that would be the favorites to go in this year.
Yeah. And we're not talking about non-wrestlers yet, but the non-wrestlers are on. But what people are looking at on the screen are non-wrestlers also, because we've got Tony Schiavone and so forth. I'm going to vote for CM Punk and Cody. And that's it, other than the non-wrestlers. The non-wrestlers I'll be voting for are, as always, Jim Johnston and Reggie Parks, as the sort of, they're in a category by themselves in terms of this is a guy who made music and the guy who made belts. I'm not voting for Ted Turner, who was almost voted in last year with, well, I mean, I don't know about almost, but he got 52% of the vote. I just view Ted Turner as somebody who's obviously very important. But I don't think, I mean, look at the documentary on him. I think it's
wrestling.
How much wrestling was there in that?
There was none. There was no wrestling beyond. I think there was a mention of the news anchors stating that they could hear the wrestling being filmed where they were nearby doing the news. Like, it couldn't have been more of a just like, yeah, those are the wacky cousins over in the far wing of Turner headquarters. That's where I struggle with Ted Turner. I am a voter for Ted Turner.
Yes.
Because I look at someone that I can't make the claim that this was somebody that was, forget deeply entrenched at all into professional wrestling. Here was a fan that had the resources to keep a company alive for as long as he did against the advice of others, that was pretty pivotal in terms of creating a distribution method by way of the Superstation to distribute Georgia Championship Wrestling nationally, to be able to create essentially wrestling in Georgia and take it through the 70s into the 80s. And what becomes of the industry if not for a Ted Turner in 1988, when the company is bleeding money and we very well could have gone into the 90s without a Jim Crockett Promotions or Mid-South and where things go from that. But I'll also say, like, the other side of it is that once we are inducting a Ted Turner and voting for that, like, this does turn into a larger discussion of the people that are multiple steps away from any kind of day-to-day or operations in pro wrestling that have had an impact that are not really that that connected to wrestling in any kind of regular type of day-to-day duties.
He did make affirmative decisions. I think he gets into an edge case of like how I hesitate to use the word indirect, because he made direct decisions that very much enabled WCW to exist and to succeed when it succeeded. But it gets into, like, I think Bonnie Hammer would be a weaker case, but it gets in that direction when we're talking about, well, do we consider network executives who really enabled the success of wrestling? David Zaslav, should we consider the candidacy of David Zaslav? Might be the only Hall of Fame he'll be getting.
I'm going to write an essay on Kevin Riley. Who threw that party in 2018? Who threw that party and invited both Kevin Riley and Tony Khan?
Right.
I'll say one, like, Nick Khan is going to have a hell of an argument. Like, the last 5 years, this guy has transformed WWE. He was the one that helped negotiate the television rights in 2018. He has been behind all of the renewals since, the deal with Netflix, the deal with Peacock, the deal with ESPN. Like, he has been sort of that point person in a lot of ways. He has had way more, like, his sole focus is WWE on a day-to-day basis. That if we're talking about executives, he's probably the most significant one of the last decade.
Yeah. And especially, so if Nick in particular, if he doesn't leave WWE in the next few years and he continues to be with WWE as the president of WWE for 10, 15 years, he won't be somebody who will be easily forgotten and will stay in conversations like the Observer Hall of Fame about who should be in. We'll see what happens with Mark Shapiro. Fan sentiment. Now, this is not just an open fan vote. This is an elite class of elitists who get to vote in this Hall of Fame. But certainly, the fan sentiment, to the extent that people are even aware of who Mark Shapiro is, we mostly at this moment associate him, you know, 2 years into the merger, with raising ticket prices, slapping sponsorship logos on things. If people were aware of it, I think people are just so barely aware of who he is. But he's certainly associated with monetizing wrestling in a way that has not been favorable to fan experience.
The reassurance you can provide.
Whoops.
We're not afraid to pound our chest about it.
Yes.
Well, if the Mark Shapiro discussion, I feel like that's my Olympic Games that I'm preparing for to go through the good and the
George
bad.
George Berrios.
I mean, certainly brought a lot of volume of hair product to his day to day. You know, we're still looking for those mythical, how many millions of fans that are worldwide that are going to sign up for the network, but perhaps him and Michelle Wilson, maybe they'll be considered like a tag team, like Inoki and Sakaguchi.
Yes. And I guess I would like to touch on something that I think about as I listen to Between the Sheets, which you did a long and really interesting talk with David Bixenspan about this Hall of Fame. Something that I realized when I listened to them go through a week of history every week is how there's so many terrible buzzwords that I'm hesitant to use, but how the smart fan point of view through the late 80s and into the 90s is sometimes a bit of a skewed way of looking at wrestling that I think would be surprising to, and certainly to at least fans, right? The fact that Bill Goldberg only got 25% of this vote, and I'm not going to vote for him either, but it would be really surprising to, I think, to a typical wrestling fan to think who's in the Wrestling Hall of Fame. Nope, not Bill Goldberg, not the Ultimate Warrior. Batista not even on this candidate list. Sid dropped off the ballot, right? These are wrestlers who I think if you're a fan, even, you know, of our age, but are just not so ingrained in talking about the minutia, that it would be surprising to you that you have such recognizable names who are not inducted candidates in this Hall of Fame.
Is there a higher threshold that a lot of bigger national stars have to overcome versus, again, I'm keeping it to this region, but we look at, That's where I really came on the fence with Sabu, that I can appreciate what he meant. Really, we're talking about 93, 95, and then the long lasting influence that he had on the industry, on performers. But we look upon him as somebody that, like, what he could draw at an independent level. And then we're looking at, like, bigger, like, Bill Goldberg had a year in 1998 that is, like, pretty much no one on this section could replicate outside of a, you know, Cody and a Punk. And I don't think any of them are single-handedly as responsible for the success versus Bill Goldberg in WCW in 1998. That was just a phenom that we observed. So I guess my question would be, if there is that tougher barrier for, you know, the stars you just listed, for instance, that don't necessarily get that support versus, you know, a Briscoes that were in a relatively smaller company in ROH for so much of their career. And their argument is largely a work-based argument and longevity together as a tag team in an industry where tag team wrestling was being de-emphasized.
Yeah, and for Goldberg, I guess it's, he was one of, maybe arguably for a series of months, the biggest star in wrestling in somewhere in 98, maybe the summer of 98. But it was such a short time frame. And then he is a star as WCW goes down, and then he just doesn't wrestle for a few years. He has this kind of disappointing run in WWE for 2003. He does come back in, what is it, 2016, and has a much more successful run in WWE with Lesnar and so forth. But it's,
The length isn't there.
And part of this Hall of Fame's explicit criteria is longevity.
Yeah.
And that's why candidates like Junkyard Dog have a hard time, because he's a big star, but it's a short period of time. Yeah. So this is definitely not a name recognition Hall of Fame. But it is, so I think that it surprises people that certain, candidates are not in.
Did you vote for Cody and Punk last year?
I did. My ballot last year was Roman Reigns, CM Punk, Cody, and the Young Bucks.
I think I was almost identical then to you last year, because I voted for Reigns, the Bucks, Cody, and Punk last year as well. Do you see Cody and Punk like one significantly a bigger candidate than the other? And how did you arrive at the decisions? Like, when did you believe like Cody crossed the threshold for you?
With this, I think last year, I think he crossed the threshold, and not before then. And I don't know if he was on the ballot before then. I guess I think Punk has a stronger case just because he's older and just has had more time to build his case. But if we were narrowly just talking about who has a stronger Hall of Fame case of the last couple of years, then maybe it would be Cody. But I think it's tough though, because Punk also came back to AEW in 2021 and helped AEW reach its hottest period ever by far. But no, I think Cody has done it as one of the top stars, one of the top two or three stars in WWE for each of these last years since 2023. He's been the WrestleMania main eventer for the last couple of years, helping this company get to the point where it's been able to monetize like no company in history has ever been able to monetize itself. Which is not to say he's a bigger star than Hulk or draw than Hulk Hogan was, but he is, along with Roman Reigns, who's now in as well, really helps this company, enabled this company to engage with fans again and grow its fan base in these post Vince McMahon years, where it has you know, seen success unlike it's seen since at least the early 2000s. And a lot of that credit has to be given to him.
And if Punk does get inducted, it will answer the question that was posed by one Phil Brooks after All Out 2022. What did I ever do, Dave? What did I ever do? Maybe this will answer that question. What he ever did if he gets inducted. Do you think any of them will acknowledge such an induction?
No. Nobody in WWE is going to acknowledge it.
No.
And
do you see?
Yeah. I wonder if, like, I think that they're probably not. Do you think Drew McIntyre is maybe Drew is. Yeah.
Like, to be quite honest, I could see Drew doing like really, really low in this. Yeah. And that's not like an indictment against Drew. I just don't see him getting any kind of support that like look at a Sami Zayn and a Kevin Owens, for instance. Like, they just fell off the ballot instantly last year. I see Drew as being closer to that grouping.
Yeah. And I see that as a flaw in how this Hall of Fame is conducted, that we're all you need to, beyond the list of candidates, other than have a strong career, is you need to be, I believe, 35 years old, is it?
Or 15 years in.
And 15 years of being in the wrestling business and at least age 35. And as maybe that made more sense in 1996 when this Hall of Fame was created as an idea. But as time goes on into the present, I mean, wrestlers are just kind of getting into their prime at age 35. And that's, I think that sort of norm is only going to get older as time goes on. I think it's kind of crazy that we're voting on candidates that young.
Well, I think it also does take a look, and, you know, I could assign this to both WWE and AEW in terms of a certain reluctance to really get behind, like, their net. Like, we are seeing a Bron Breakker that would be a departure from this, but like a Drew McIntyre, he's, I believe, 40 years old. He's been wrestling for 2 decades, and we're talking about him as, like, he's just in the midst right now of really entering, like, those key years in WWE. Like, he had the title run in 2020, but it feels like such an incomplete career. Whereas, you know, a generation ago, we'd be talking about this guy, like, being on the downside and, like, slowing things down. Like, a Hulk Hogan was 40 by the time, like, 1993 rolls around. Like, there is sort of that belief that, you know, you, some of these talents, it's a really long period before company is fully behind you. And we have like a main event scene of like Cody is 40, Jey Uso is 40, Drew is 40, Punk is 47
Reigns is 40.
Reigns is 40. Like, there are, like, we're talking about like 35 is now considered like youthful. It's like, I'm looking at like where are our mid 20s performers, and like those are considered like, man, you're going to be in NXT for years if you're in your early 20s. Like, it's very rare that we see someone in that 20s age bracket that's going to skyrocket on a main roster. Like, on either side. Like, there's exceptions here and there, but not.
John Moxley is 39 for now until next month. You have voted for Moxley?
I did vote for Moxley. Yeah.
You're voting for him this year?
I am voting for him again this year. Okay. I think he's been very important to AEW. I think that this past year, you know, the Death Riders angle was definitely a polarizing one, but I think ultimately the build up to All In, I think he was very key to the success of that show. I think that he has been someone that has been like a stabilizing force in AEW. Not that that is necessarily an argument for Hall of Fame inclusion, but I think he's been really important to AEW, and not in a grandiose type of fashion. But I think that when you look at 2019, I think he is one of those ingredients that allowed them to get off to as hot a start as they did. He was their champion throughout the pandemic. And I do give a lot of credence to that first class of AEW that 4 months in, they get that new deal from TNT in January of 2020. Like, that is a lifesaver for AEW right before the pandemic. And, you know, your Jerichos, your Moxleys, your Codys, your Omegas, like, they're all part of that mix. And the fact that they got through year one, where the odds were stacked against this company to begin with, and then you throw in a pandemic, like, it is really impressive that they come out of that generally unscathed and reaching like where they are now, where they're at least on stable footing throughout the length of this contract.
Moxley is somebody who I think I will vote for eventually, if he doesn't just get in before I vote for him. there are maybe, I don't know if there's anybody else left. Like I expect that Mercedes Moné, Sasha Banks, I would probably vote for eventually. Goldberg, maybe I would eventually vote for him. The others, not yet.
Do you see Mercedes as a stronger candidate than Becky Lynch?
I did think about that because you and Bix talked about that. I don't know. It's hard to say. It's hard to say.
Like, is Becky's rise in like 2019, is that the issue I have is that, yes, she reaches this unbelievable level in 2019, and it's one that is.
I would view Mercedes is more of an influential case, which, by the way, there's these sort of three criteria that you're supposed to consider, which is drawing power. In-ring work is one, right? Mm-hmm. And influence or historical significance. And I would say that Mercedes' influence is probably greater than Becky Lynch, but Becky Lynch is not zero there either.
Yeah. It's one that, like, when I look at who has had the most influence on the WWE's direction and the women's division as a whole over this last decade, it's Ronda Rousey, I think, clearly. And I don't
not
think she's
Gallet ever.
She'll never get any support if she was on this. Like, I think a lot of fans view her as like this negative. And granted, I don't think she does herself a whole lot of favors with a lot of her commentary, but like, she is the
reason.
Would
you vote for Ronda Rousey?
I'd give it thought. I'd certainly give it thought because it, like, that whole give divas a chance deal, like, that's happening as she's waxing Kat Zingano in 28 seconds, and she is a phenom in mixed martial arts. And that was the impetus behind, you know, NXT getting behind a women's division, behind the whole transfer of how they viewed their women's division, that it could be a significant part of their card makeup and the direction that a lot of these
characters.
Now
you're talking about a time where she has never had one pro wrestling match yet. She just so happens to cross over from MMA into pro wrestling later.
Yes. I mean, she does come over to wrestling, and I think that, like, is Becky in the position of headlining a WrestleMania if there's not a Ronda Rousey involved?
I see. No.
I don't know what the answer is. I'm not saying she gets in, but it's definitely one that I would at least give some thought to. You know, Brock Lesnar, like, he got inducted into this Hall of Fame, I think, greatly on the weight of his UFC career. So, like, we have some of those candidates. It's like, how much do you really assess that? Like, is Brock Lesnar, if you take out all of the UFC, like, how do you weigh his wrestling portion, especially when he got inducted into this, which was, you know, years and years ago?
It's one of the wider issues. I guess it's just reflective of the Observer's coverage, right? Is that there's, mm-hmm. I don't think we're weighing MMA into this. I don't think we should, right? I mean, Brock's UFC career is in this transitional period where
draw from a lot of wrestling fans for success in another arena that we're not really voting upon, but then does bring that back to WWE, where he's certainly a protected star.
His UFC career is sort of overlaying this point in time where wrestling fans, where the wrestling fan base and the UFC fan base are splitting apart, where I think mm-hmm. that now they're pretty far apart. So I certainly at this point, we're not considering, Conor McGregor is not a candidate here. Kazushi Sakuraba is not in this Hall of Fame, right?
No.
But he would be an interesting case in that his stardom is totally in MMA, right? It's in the rise of Pride in the early 2000s, the Gracie Hunter and all that. Although he came out of pro wrestling and wasn't as, you know, the story was that he was defending pro wrestling from all these MMA fighters mm-hmm. who were trying to kill pro wrestling. And they eventually did in Japan, which led
and then Wanderlei Silva nearly killed him multiple times. Yes. Some very vicious fights that he had. But again, a lot of it was like he was representing pro wrestling, but all the mm-hmm. business he drew was for Pride. As well. Again, like with Ronda Rousey, influence is one section, and I think she's very high on influence. The other category, she's not going to hold up to either. I don't look at any of her WWE runs as especially transformative, at all. But like, again, if you're someone that can vote for someone just based on influence, like that is Ronda's case right there. But again, I wouldn't even necessarily advocate for her being on the ballot because I think she would get so little support. that it would just be, you know, a futile exercise.
You wouldn't definitely vote for her.
What's that?
You wouldn't definitely vote for her.
Oh, I definitely would. Like, I would give it thought. I'd give it a lot deeper thought. I wouldn't say 100% yes or no at all. I would, you know, there's the influence factor, but
yeah,
there's not a whole lot beyond that in terms of what she did during her two runs in the company.
We've talked about this much longer than I anticipated, yes. but I want to ask too, like, have you ever advocated for getting someone on the ballot?
No, I never have.
No. I asked for Jim Johnson to be put on the ballot. I don't think I'm the only one. But I think that is part of our sacred duty as Hall of Fame voters is to ask for people to be on the ballot. Cause I think, you know, Dave does listen to this. I think Batista probably should be on the ballot, especially listening to you and Bix talk about it. He is as the person who's looked at the filings, maybe the most, I think you do see, you know, I mean, we all remember Cena better because Cena had the much longer uninterrupted career in pro wrestling.
Batista was the needle mover before Cena. Like everyone thinks like they're both coronated at that same WrestleMania in 05, but it's like Batista is the A star of those two. And he is the one that, you know, draws really well with Hunter, not just at that Mania, but the follow-up matches that they do on pay-per-view. He is the one that is moving numbers much before Cena does. And a lot of Cena's, you know, Cena is considered like this band-aid at a time when 03, 04 business is falling. And those two are the ones that kind of get things at least, stabilized during what's kind of like a down period for the company, but not as low as the previous years.
Mm-hmm. So maybe I might think about asking for Batista because I don't think you should ask for anybody on the ballot who you're not definitely going to vote for. And I'll think about it. Has there ever been, so there's in the non-wrestler category, there's managers, promoters, bookers, Ted Turners, and there's some journalists on here. So Bill Apter is in now, right? I guess there are some living people. I was going to ask, are there any living reporters who've been candidates, and Bill Apter is one, and he's in, right? Because I was going to say, well, why don't we have Wade Keller on this ballot? I think we don't have Dave Meltzer because it's Dave Meltzer's Hall of Fame. This would be like maybe somebody should be the Nick Khan to his Paul Levesque here, and just announce that he's on the ballot against his will.
They'll just announce it at the Observer headquarters meeting with everybody. Yeah, in terms of like reporters, like there's Koichi Yoshizawa who died recently, and that was why he was added. He was added last year.
Stanley Weston is one who's in the historical category.
Right, he's on here, but yeah, living, not any other reporters. James Melby has passed away. Larry Matizek has passed away. Mike Tenay is on the category, but you know he did reporting. He did like actual reporting before he became a broadcaster. And there's been, you know, a lot of advocacy for Mike Tenay. I didn't vote for Tenay this year, but
much more famous as a TV commentator.
Yeah, I think he's largely being voted in or out based on his broadcast work, as is, I assume, Gorilla Monsoon for a lot of people. Like, I don't think it's his behind the scenes work, like his ownership in the WWF or Puerto Rico. It's going to be your affinity or lack thereof for him as a broadcaster.
Yeah. So, but I think Wade, if we're considering people who did important reporting and who have been influential on how we report about pro wrestling. Okay. Maybe we're not going to put Dave on here because it's his Hall of Fame, but then we have to put Wade on here. And I guess, you know, everyone says in defense of that, well, it's, you know, we can't put Wade in without putting Dave in, but I mean,
I think you would look at Wade Keller as someone that could totally fit on this list and be someone of discussion. I don't know what Dave's thoughts are on like when it comes to reporters. It is kind of weird for like, I can understand not wanting to put yourself on this ballot. I sure as hell would not want to do that with myself, nor would I ever want to be on a ballot. But it's something to look at, especially when we are talking about, you know, people like Bill Apter and such and others that like the precedent has been set that reporters can be placed on this. And yeah, a Keller would be one of those. Maybe Norm DaCosta as well from the Toronto Star. No?
Did he break some wrestling stories? That name sounds familiar.
He definitely was an Observer reader. Was a big fan of the Anabolic Warrior, as he would call him in his weekly column. All right. Well, there you have it. So we have got Brandon's ballot, and yeah, I'm voting for in the non-wrestler category. I'm voting for Dave Brown, Bobby Bruns, Morris Siegel, Ted Turner, Jesse Ventura, Roy Welch, and I am voting for Koichi Yoshizawa. So I am maxing out on the non-wrestlers. And there you have it. The deadline is this week, and then the issue will be out in the coming weeks, and maybe we'll go over the results when they come out, see who goes in. We went very lengthy on this.
Yes.
We are 40 minutes into the show. TKO earnings tonight. A wonderful Wednesday night earnings release. Nothing better than a Wednesday evening, a quiet Wednesday evening for an earnings report slash call. We're going to get Mark Shapiro talking to us about what they achieved in the third quarter of 2025. Any grand expectations going into this earnings call? We have among the highlights, certainly probably a lot of focus on the launch on ESPN for the company, the announcement of WrestleMania going to Saudi Arabia in 2027, probably some discussion on TKO boxing and staging the Canelo Terrence Crawford fight over this past quarter. And of course, Big Data Plus panel that I'm sure will be the tip of everyone's tongue to get to the bottom of these
declines. I don't know whether it'll be asked or not by this set of analysts, but I think it's absolutely an important question concerning their media rights. I don't know if we're going to transition into that discussion, but I'll pull up the chart here. Your ratings, at least the SmackDown ratings, and your NXT ratings, SmackDown is down 22% under this methodology. NXT is down 15% under this methodology. We only have, I think, one UFC number to look at, which is the prelims, which did, I don't know if I have it here, did 519, which is in the range of, I guess, what they had done previously. So I don't know if it's affecting UFC in the same way. And UFC is probably just categorized as sports. So maybe that it's not being hindered in the way that wrestling is. But does this change how you should, if you're down suddenly under this new methodology? This is not just a result of cord cutting. You're suddenly down 20% on SmackDown. Does that, should I be thinking about that as an investor, which I'm not? Should I be thinking about that as an investor as a cut by 20% in how these media rights fees are going to be assessed? Now you are still ranking highly despite getting crushed by the World Series and lots of, I think there's college football maybe on that night too. But is it just, are you assured from NBC Universal and people like that that's not going to have a big change in the way that they're going to value your media rights?
Yeah, I'm somewhat stunned that we are, this Big Data Plus panel methodology came into effect in late September. So we have over a month now. This was not just like a week or two of bugs in the system and there was like a normalization. No, this is the new normal that we're seeing. And even if you want to give some credence that they've been up against the like a pretty well-watched Major League Baseball playoff season.
But I've got the year-over-year here. This is
still way down.
Gone against the World Series.
That's it. Like, we still have last year, at least for the October data, they were up against a bigger series with the Yankees-Dodgers last year than they were this year. So there's not even that to rest upon. Like, this, to me, is a very alarming story, and it's really got no attention in any kind of like significant ways outside of like wrestling media of where these numbers are across the board. This is not like a one-off that it's only affecting some programs. Like, this feels as though it is AEW and WWE that have taken this really on the chin throughout this period. But I don't know if this is really going to cross the threshold and be addressed in any kind of meaningful way on this call, but yeah, this is something that you 100% should be focused upon, because this has been kind of your lifeblood, is these numbers and what we can attract to continue to get these escalating fees.
It's something that's probably way undercovered and something that I should be focusing on more. I have thoughts about how to address that. But it's not something that's being talked about. And I have questions like, are these wrestling companies doing anything to to talk to Nielsen about why are they measuring so differently when sports are doing just fine. A lot of other programming is doing just fine. There are other scripted programs that I've pulled up the data for to see how they're doing before and after. And you have things like the Challenge, the things that are some of Dynamite's direct competition are also strongly down. But why are we measuring differently? And I mean, if there's ever a question that's central to your finances and how you should look at your financial future, it's what your ratings are. And I've always stressed here that, well, the rank is the thing that really matters the most, but I bet we're going to see some differences in rank here too, even though we should mention that SmackDown still ranked number one despite going under 1 million viewers this past Friday. But this should be, you know, this is what your currency is based on. It's what your ad sales are sold against. And this is a huge factor into how your media rights values are going to be assessed in your next round of negotiating. So you have to be investigating why you're measuring so differently.
Margin expansion, adjusted EBITDA margin expansion.
Mm-hmm. All these factors, Brandon, that we have to take into account. You tabulated the market to market comparisons for both WWE and AEW for the past month. And we'll start with WWE. And what did you see here? The big question is the bloom off the rose, as has been, suggested.
Well, I pull it up here. Is the boom over with?
Is this it? Did we miss the boom?
It has to, business always has to coincide with my experience as a fan. And a lot of people are saying, that the creative hasn't been that great this year. This is what they do. It's what they do. Well, we are seeing, so this is Q4 to date. We're 1 month in, one third of the way through Q4. And WWE, what's a market-to-market comparison? A market-to-market comparison, by my definition here, is I'm looking at the Raw in this town, the SmackDown in this town, compared to the last time in this town that the same event type, that is Raw or SmackDown, were in that town. And we have four negative comparisons and two positive comparisons. And this is this is not something that we've seen, at any time really recently for WWE, which has been on a pretty tremendous hot streak since, 2023. Now the quarter is not yet over with. So this is not in the books. They have 2 months to straighten this out and get that margin expansion going again. Now, you could say this on one hand, this is only based on the WrestleTix estimate of tickets distributed. I believe there was the one show in, was it Utah? In Salt Lake City. That was, I think just this past Friday on Halloween. That was, I think under 5,000 or something like that. Don't quote
4,226. Yeah. And this was also back to back nights in the same arena, because this is where they also held Saturday night's main event the next night.
Right. So as a result, we have so far in Q4, SmackDown is down averaging just under 7,000, whereas it's been over 10,000 in each of the last 2 years. But Raw is still averaging higher so far in this quarter versus the last 2 years. We should mention, you know, ticket prices have more than doubled, as my reporting has shown. So despite, I mean, they could cut attendance in half and they would still be making more revenue. So basically no doubt here that they're, even if these attendances fall a little bit, they're still making a lot more revenue because they're charging double the price. So all this is something to take into consideration. And if you're trying to answer the question about what's the state of popularity for WWE, is it up, is it down in terms of fan engagement? You've got to take this as one thing along with some other things, although the other things are harder and harder to understand.
Yeah, I think that this is very clearly, and how you, like, if you are running this business of, in a comparison point of just number of people versus what the per average spend is by person that is coming in, like your attendance, as you mentioned, it could slide, but you are making so much more money off those that are still attending that your revenue for these shows is that much more. And I think that is
more work to do there too, by the way. Don't get comfortable with the prices being doubled. It's going to go even higher.
That's what we call in the industry step one. Okay. That's, you just wait. So then we compare to AEW. What about AEW? How does this
affect about AEW?
AEW, of course, our favorite segment every week. So again, you have five market to market comparisons throughout the month of October. And I see a handful of negatives here.
It's still, I believe, a largely negative story for AEW. It is.
Oh dear.
We had four negative stories and one positive story in the month of October. On average, the mark-to-market comparison was down 21%. So we do have this one positive story, which is Jacksonville. But then they went the next night, and we're down from the prior collision in Jacksonville. We do have a pay-per-view comparison here, and it's a fairly like-to-like comparison where we have, was it Dynasty of last year being compared to the, what was the pay-per-view that just happened?
Wrestle Dream.
It was down 34% from Dynasty, for this, I'm sorry. No, it was down 5%. The Dynamite was down 34% from the 2023 Dynamite. Then we had San Antonio down 66%.
Yeah, that's I didn't realize that they did that many last December for, San Antonio, because yeah, they were under 2,000 for this, for last week's show at the Boeing Center, which is also the same venue NXT is about to run in a few weeks for their deadline event as well. So San Antonio, get ready for more pro wrestling coming your way. Is there anything, you recently did your quarterly earnings call with, Josh Nason, no affiliation with AEW. This is an unofficial earnings call you do every quarter.
We are not affiliated with AEW or Nielsen.
Nope. That is not. You can direct all inquiries to, the legal firm of Thurston and Company. But what did you, look at in terms of, AEW, their key performance indicators for the third quarter, which would include, All in Texas in July, Forbidden Door in August, and then All Out in September here in Toronto.
Yeah, I think we've basically just touched on it by looking at TV ratings and attendance, but it's what you would expect, right? TV ratings are down. Dynamite's down 34%, but that's in a year-over-year comparison that includes not yet Big Data plus panel, because remember, this is just ending in September. Right. So there might be like one episode out of 13 here, but down 34%, but it's concluding that, you know, there's no simulcast to be accounted for here. Nonetheless, it's down really strongly in the demo for both Collision and Dynamite. It's down 12 and 8% respectively, Dynamite and Collision, for total viewership as well. And mainly what we've just talked about, it was a continuation in Q3 of attendance being down. Well, there's some residencies, but the residencies are being had because attendance is down. That keeps costs down doing events repeatedly in the same venue. 2,500 was the average for Q3, down from almost 4,000 in the prior year quarter. Collision is down as well. Pay-per-view attendance is down, but that's a pay-per-view that, you know, that's All In versus the Wembley, years before it. So, but pay-per-view buys, according to the Observer's reports of them, if you believe them, that it's basically even.
I would look at like these last three shows as like, again, if you are going with this, as like the range of buys that they got, like, Forbidden Door was essentially even with the prior years. All in Texas was up from the prior years. And the bigger one to me is All Out, because not only were they up, it was, you know, you're putting in like a Hangman Page, Kyle Fletcher main event, and you're going against the ESPN debut, from WWE with WrestlePalooza. So the fact that they, maintained that, like, I do feel like these head to head, comparisons have viewed fairly favorably for AEW, that, you know, they went up against, both an NXT show and Saturday night's main event with the All in Texas show. And the result was a Saturday night's main event that was considered like a underachieving show when it came to audience, and turned out to be the last show that is airing on NBC for them, as they have now just moved exclusively to Peacock. And we don't have any head to heads scheduled for the rest of the year. And it does make you think that AEW, at least through this leg of these competitive nights, came out of it relatively unscathed in comparison to, I think, what some of the projections were going to be, that this was going to be a disaster going against a main roster PLE that they had to in September.
Yeah. I mean, as far as this data, I think you can at least tell yourself an economic story that makes sense, in that you have, let's say, imagine you have a funnel, and the least hardcore product you have is the television that the most unengaged, non-hardcore person can watch, can consume, watch the TV show, turn it on or off. And then I think down from that, and that is the thing that is down severely, even if you include a reasonable assumption about what's happening on streaming. Then you have ticket sales. Well, I don't think everybody who attends an AEW show is going to buy the pay-per-view, and that is down pretty significantly as well. You have pay-per-view being the most hardcore, the hardest to change, the hardest to diminish audience is holding up. And that is a story that is coherent.
Yeah. And it's a question we can't answer without, significantly looking at like the people buying these pay-per-views, but it would be interesting to know, like, as AEW has now moved to pretty much an every 4 week formula for its pay-per-views, like what percentage of these people that are buying the pay-per-views has that at all disrupted their weekly viewing of AEW? Are these people that they get their excellent AEW 4 to 5 hour pay-per-view, and then they come back 4 weeks later? They don't necessarily need to follow the week-to-week television, and they get more than enough every 4 weeks now that they're satisfied. It's not like a 2-3 month wait between pay-per-views where the TV is like, it's now to some, perhaps like it's like in addition to, but the core experience for an AEW fan is the pay-per-view every 4 weeks now.
Should we talk about how this data is reported? Because I see we have some chatter in here about whether we should believe this data. How is this data being attributed by the Observer? This is, I understand Dave recently said that he has something like 5 sources he's claiming, to come up with this data. I don't know how,
like I can't break down what his methodology is. If we're going based on he is getting from 5 sources in the cable industry, and then going with, what he believes to be his best understanding of what the buys are, like, that's what we're limited to here. So I caution to make any stern point based off of this, but I feel that at worst, we're talking about numbers that are at least in the ballpark. I think if they were, let's put it this way. If All Out was, do you really believe that All Out did half this number or double this number? I don't. But of course, this is going to be unscientific, that we're not going to get the exact number, but we are limited with what data we have. But like, Brandon, if you had 5 cable industry sources giving you data, like, would you feel confident?
I want to parse that too. I don't know that he's saying he has 5 cable industry sources. He's saying he has 5 sources. Now, does that mean he has multiple people from the same organization telling him something similar? I think Dave could do himself a service and mitigate this sort of discussion by being, while still anonymizing, being more clear about
the source,
about the sourcing is
without, of course, revealing that.
Yeah.
It's valid. But I think like that is, again, when we are trying to assess this, these are kind of like the difficulties in trying to assess, what was successful, what was not successful, what is working. Cause certainly the pay-per-view, you look at that compared to all your other breakdowns, like that is probably the most positive picture of AEW. And it's also the one that they are, probably represents your most engaged audience members that are willing to spend $50 every month on a pay-per-view.
Yes.
All right. We're going to move to Japan, not literally, but on the topic sheet. New Japan has put out a new attendance figure for Wrestle Kingdom, which is 2 months away, as Hiroshi Tanahashi has revealed that he is now responsible for 31,548 tickets being sold based on his retirement.
Only him.
I think, with all due respect, Aaron Wolf, I think, can he can lay credit to some of this, but this is the Hiroshi Tanahashi farewell event. And Brandon, compared to past Wrestle Kingdom events, how does 31,548 stack up over the past decade?
It stacks up pretty favorably, especially compared to recent years. It's already surpassed the numbers of 2023, 2024, and 2025, which at best did 27,000, right? We got 2023 did 26,000, 2024 did 27,422, and last year did 24,107. This one already at 31,548, according to New Japan. So, it's, what was the Liger retirement? Was that 2020?
That was 2020.
Yeah. And that was a 2-day Wrestle Kingdom that did 40,000 and then another 30,000 and change the next day. So I mean, it's reasonable to think about this getting to 40. And
then Liger retired and business plummeted, right?
Yes, it did. Well, the pandemic also happened.
Oh.
And then Okada and Ospreay and Kenny Omega all left. Well, that was actually just, well, you get the point. I think everybody in wrestling is realizing lately how great it is to retire. We got Cody Rhodes, I understand, talking about how his next contract might be his last.
AJ John Styles.
AJ Styles is next on the docket.
That'd be a John great heel gimmick for MJF. Yes. He announces he's going to retire.
I thought about doing that as an independent wrestler, like having a gimmick where I just retired every show. But I think that, yes, Sting's retirement was AEW's probably last. Well, no, it wasn't. Sting's retirement did a really strong gate and a really strong buy rate, reportedly.
Yes.
But
Tam Nakano this past year in Stardom.
Okay.
Yeah. Terry Funk in 1983. All of these to be covered on Rewind Away's Greatest Retirement Matches Ever compilation on Thursday, by the way. Cheap plug.
But I do think this is something that this is kind of a. It has dawned on the wrestling business that retiring draws. So I think we may see more of this now, whether or not we see people uphold their retirements.
And well,
is always a question.
You know, if Turkey wants you, he'll get you.
He will.
My question to you, how much money then did Steve Austin leave on the table in 2003, only telling Vince McMahon and Jim Ross of his plans to retire?
I think it was different in 2003, right?
Yeah.
A retirement would not be consumed in the same way. I think there's a lot to think about on that, right? Like I don't know if people would just believe it less at that time. I don't know that people do believe the Cena retirement, this time. He's been emphatic about, I'm not going to go back on it.
Rusev isn't convinced.
Okay. Well, it takes a lot to convince Rusev of anything, I think. I don't know. There wasn't such nostalgia. The wrestling fan was different at that time, right? The wrestling fan wasn't as ready to appreciate a career in a whole way like they do now, like you've seen with the Sting retirement, the Cena retirement.
So you look at this Wrestle Kingdom number. I mean, all indications they will surpass the 2018 number, which is a significant show because that was the Jericho Omega year that. You know, they got a big jump off the past year. The big markers of 2019 and 2020. I don't know, like maybe they can hit those. Those are kind of ambitious, markers to assume if they can hit. But I also look at this, like this is really going to be an indication of like Tanahashi's, like the value of this as an event people want to be at because. Like, I don't know what New Japan is going to have on the horizon beyond this show. This is sort of going to inflate New Japan in 2026 because you'll look at this number. And I don't know what post-Tanahashi retirement is going to look like for a company that, I mean, did terrible attendance for the G1. And it's a relative cold product, but they have this really significant event to promote on January 4th that they can only do for one night.
Yeah. We don't know who his opponent is yet.
Not
would
yet.
Would it serve New Japan to like, what's like that? That's a problem that you've just described. Is there anything they can do in Tanahashi's match, such as put over some new star that could serve that problem?
I don't think so. Like they tried to do that this weekend with Yota Tsuji, and they're definitely trying to make Yota Tsuji now the kind of, you know, the person to rise in Tanahashi's, like in his, footsteps.
So what happened? Did they wrestle each other?
Yes.
And did
you finally win? Beat him and then
Tanahashi?
He beat Tanahashi over the weekend. Yeah.
Okay.
This didn't make its way to your newsfeed.
This is not Misawa beating Saruta, apparently.
Not quite. They didn't make a call earlier in the day based on the reception. We talk about New Japan being somewhat cold overall. You decided to break down how the other Japanese promotions are doing as well over this past quarter with comparisons. Is there anyone that is standing out above the rest? Is how dire of a picture can you paint for us in terms of the Japanese wrestling economy? Is it thriving?
It's let's see. So far year to date. So let's talk about averages. Well, this is in the current quarter. I might do this recurringly from here out. But we have, I guess if you're talking about trends, the easier thing is to look at these, is to look at these changes over time. And we do see, New Japan is down, by double digits in the quarter. It was down double digits in total. And, on the quarter, it was down 9%, from the prior year. Where it was actually flat in Q2, but let's think Q3 this is a calendar year, is July, August, September. So that would include, the G1 Climax, which is, normally a really strong period for them. Now on the Bushiroad, filings, we can see Stardom though was up 40%. Now, caveat, these are all announced attendances. I think the Bushiroad companies are being honest because it's a publicly traded company, and we've seen since the middle of 2015 that New Japan attendances seem to be rather honest. But Stardom up on average. 40%.
All I would say is that if they wanted to be pulling the wool over their eyes, they're doing a terrible job with New Japan. I don't know if I would be lying about these numbers.
Yeah. So Stardom seems to be doing well. Noah is relatively flat. All Japan is relatively flat. Dragon Gate is down 9% on average.
Buyer's market. If you're in Japan, you can probably get reasonably priced tickets. You're complaining about your family can't afford to go to WWE. Get on a plane and go to Japan for New Year's. You can see all the wrestling you want for a very affordable pricing, I imagine.
That's right. If you're buying those premium tickets, it's similar cost.
Let's catch up on the world of Paul Levesque. He's a very busy man. He's shooting WrestleMania commercials on top of buildings, on top of Allegiant Stadium. He's doing, he's the centerpiece of the brand new WrestleMania 42 poker ad as well. We don't have Tanahashi's opponent for Wrestle Kingdom. We also don't have Paul Levesque's opponent for WrestleMania, but he's all over the advertising. So he's got to be in a big match. He's the focus.
Who is?
Paul Levesque.
He's on Wrestle Kingdom?
No. Maybe he'll be the mystery opponent. He was the mystery guest for the All In podcast that held a panel discussion in front of a live audience last week. And, we know you don't have 26 minutes of free time. You're busy people. So we have put together, the highlights of this discussion as, the Almighty made his way onto the stage.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the WWE's Paul Levesque.
So the audience may not know this, but I'm a big professional wrestling fan. Going back to my childhood in Memphis, Tennessee, professional wrestling at the Mid-South Coliseum on Monday nights. That was Jerry pretty Lawler. Much it. Jerry Lawler was so popular in Memphis that he could have been elected mayor, and I think he almost was.
It's amazing to me when I walk through the White House. Over the last few months, I've been there quite a few times. How many people in the White House are huge fans of WWE? The one thing about WWE is we're a fun reflection of the world. It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be entertainment. It's supposed to be fantastical. It's supposed to let you come to an event for 3 hours and just turn off and enjoy entertainment and some type of representation of the world that is around you. But people get lost in it, and they begin to take the representations too seriously sometimes. And people within our business sometimes take this wrong, but we don't write the shows based on that'll be a great match. We write it on the stories that we can create. The protagonist, the antagonist, how does that work with each other? Telling stories that can resonate with people. When you talk about a content company that puts out entertainment, we are live Monday nights, 2 to 3 hours, depending on the evening on Netflix. Tuesday nights, 2 hours on CW. Friday nights, 2 hours, and half the year is 3 hours on USA.
Half the year is 3 hours on USA.
I nearly crumbled when I heard that line. That did not sound like this past year was just a one-off, Brandon. I feel what's going to happen in January. Oh my God. That was no one took away that comment right there, but that was frightening to me.
Yeah. I think that's consistent with everything we've seen. And that makes sense that there'll be, that's a compromise. I'm sure they reached in this renewal at some point.
A lot packed in there from Paul Levesque. People focus way too much on representation.
What does that mean? Representation of what?
I don't know.
I read that. So that was in the context of talking about like reductive stereotypical characters that have been in WWE. Cause there was Iron Sheik was, had been mentioned by
the question was about reflecting like geopolitical tension within your storytelling and how that would be met by people. And Levesque's response was about it's going to offend people in that particular part of the world. I'm paraphrasing by just limiting it to one stereotype instilled in a character.
Yes. I took that as him saying, we don't do stereotypical characters, at least as much anymore. Mm. And he did hedge after that, saying that because people, something to the effect of people will get offended by, even if they don't have a stake on either side, I guess, which is to say, you're getting offended about it, even though you're not a member of that community or something like that.
Yes. Unless you're Kit Wilson and, the libs are your primary target with that specific character, but we digress. Yeah, I mean, it was generally some of the questions ranged from, about like their content distribution to, man, this stuff hurts. Stuff really hurts, doesn't it? And he's like, yeah, it's not ballet. And then I guess the quote everyone ran with was, his line about they don't book for great matches, I guess inferring that that's some kind of knock toward AEW. I didn't listen to that as like this.
You know, I didn't take AEW from that at
combative
all.
Answer from Paul Levesque. I mean, and he's one that, I mean, if you can tell with his tone, I think when he is kind of a thumbing his nose at others, I didn't take it to be that either. That was it. It was and a lot of fans of WWE in the White House. Surprise, surprise.
Well, he's talking to the right audience here. The All In podcast.
You're telling me, I'm not familiar with this podcast, but you brought me up to speed.
I've never listened to it, but I do know who these people are. It's vaguely. These are big tech entrepreneurs. David Sachs, Chamath Palihapitiya, Jason Calacanis, and there's at least one other individual.
Do you think David Sachs voted for Dave Brown in the non-wrestler category?
I doubt he gets a ballot.
Big Memphis fan. All right. Well, there you go. We saved you 26 minutes. I don't think anything else was too earth shattering in that discussion beyond this fear of what comes January, because I might be retiring from SmackDown duty at that point. I'm too old for this.
Maybe I'll take it over.
I can't do 3 hours anymore, but hey, Brandon, I will be more than happy to hand the mantle over to. Let's do some ratings discussion before we get out of here. So going back a week, man, these numbers get so delayed, Brandon. I mean, it's I don't like this whole waiting period that we have. It just feels like forever that we've got to get these numbers out. But last week, some pretty awful viewership numbers. I don't know how to color this any better than that. NXT did 527,000 viewers, 0.07 in the demo. Dynamite doing 459,000 viewers, a 0.08 in the demo. SmackDown, as Brandon mentioned, under a million viewers, 933,000, which was down 19% week over week. Demo 0.20, which was down 31%. And then an astounding number. Okay, Brandon, this past Saturday night, Collision going against this insane Game 7. They fall 5% in viewers, 217,000 viewers. The demo is a 0.03. Women were down more than half from the previous week. Men, unchanged. I couldn't believe this. Like, these are 27,000 viewers, all men. They are not missing Collision if their house was on fire, okay? This is, they are strapped to their couch from 8 till 10 on TNT on a Saturday night. They are not missing 1 minute of Collision, no matter what is going on in the world.
Yeah, well, what was on this episode of Collision that we can attribute the drawing power to?
We certainly have to look toward, what did we have? Oh, it's Mercedes Moné and Olympia.
Okay.
So maybe this is part of, Mercedes Moné's, candidacy, is her ability to retain male viewers against Game 7 of the World Series.
That's right.
All right. Any other, SmackDown? These were their lowest numbers in their history this past Friday night. But I mean, with the caveat, we had not only the World Series, but also Halloween night. This was,
yes.
I think I'm more interested in seeing how, SmackDown, and by extension, several of these other programs fare in November.
Now I would expect this to be the record low for a long time.
Yeah, it would be hard to imagine them falling below this or having anything against them that's going to be in excess of 24 million viewers on top of, you know, not quite a holiday, but pretty much adjacent to it in Halloween.
Yeah.
All right. Was there anything else you wanted to get to that we did not touch upon, Brandon? I want to make sure all your slides are represented here on the show.
Oh, I don't know. We had the betting scandal.
Oh,
UFC fighters continue. Well, go ahead.
Well, this past Saturday, there was a fight between Isaac Dalgarian and this Yadier Delval. And this was a fight that folks had never heard of these two fighters before Saturday night, even MMA fans. Dalgarian was a sizable favorite going into this fight. And then in the hours leading up, the line started to swing with all this money coming in on Delval. And Dana White has since confirmed that they were notified of this. They are partnered with this group called IC360 that used to be called US Integrity. Somehow in there, they decided a rebranding would be in order. And they got in touch with the fighter. He maintained he's not hurt. He doesn't owe people money. He doesn't know why this line swing is happening. So they allowed the fight to take place. And to be charitable, Isaac Dalgarian like shit the bed in this fight. He fought a terrible fight. He was submitted in the first round. Dana White said as soon as this fight ended, his eyebrows were raised and he immediately went backstage and called the FBI.
Are you serious?
We've all been there, Brandon.
He said he called the FBI.
He called the FBI.
He does have a friend who works there.
I think, yeah, it's, he has cash on delivery on his phone. So he contacts
was cash at the event.
He was not at the event. And
was this in Las Vegas?
It was in Las Vegas. It was at the Apex.
He lives there.
Cash Patel isn't going to the Apex. He only goes to number of events. Which is a whole separate thing that now the UFC is going to be subject to an investigation. And whether you believe, there is a reason FBI directors do not attend and be chummy with now people that they literally have to investigate. But I think the horse has left the barn on that discussion. But yeah, Dana White said
that. Jim Comey to be the FBI director?
Could you imagine? And this, by the way, comes a week after the whole FBI reveal of the NBA betting scandals as well. Right. So this is a pretty big story. Ariel Helwani has done a lot of reporting on this, that he has been in contact with fighters that have said they, too, have been approached in the past about compromising fights. And the fact that this is not just some one-off incident, that you have the combination of fighters that are, you know, especially lower end fighters that are very underpaid, that are
underpaid.
That's the rumor that goes around. And
UFC's making record revenue, though.
Well, I only go by what their settlement reads from the Kung Lee lawsuit, that apparently some of these fighters have been underpaid along the way.
Well, this sounds like a great way for them to make extra money. I think, you know, just take a lesson from the old time pro wrestlers here. Maybe what's this individual's name? Isaac Dalgarian was reading about, you know, Farmer Burns and the Barnstormer era. I think this is a great way to do it, especially, I mean, look at the opportunity around all these sports betting businesses.
Well, back in the Farmer Burns days, where the term mark emerged from unsuspecting fans that could be hoodwinked, today, those same people are now registering with DraftKings and Caesars and other sports books. And I don't think this outrage is over the integrity of this sport. It's, I don't want to be putting my money down on fights that are out of my control. And it does become a question of how much this impacts the confidence that fans are going to have to bet on these fights, which have become a huge revenue center for the UFC. They are in partnership with DraftKings, which apparently is one of the only sports books that has not offered credits in exchange for those that lost money on this fight, whereas other books have done that and given credits for. The questions become, and Dana White has basically stated, the FBI is now investigating this, how far spread this is among other fighters, if this is something that is contained to this one fight, or something that, as Ariel Helwani has reported, multiple fighters have been approached over time to compromise fights. And if fans are going to have this belief that, I'm not going to bet on these fights because I don't have confidence that these fights are as they appear to be. And if this has not gained the level of traction of the NBA betting scandal, but like this is a very prominent story, and I can see it really having a detrimental effect on fan engagement, at least when it comes to like sports books and betting on these fights.
I would say this is a great opportunity for UFC fighters to say, hey, just pay us more. And we'll, maybe we won't be tempted by this, but you know, they'll have cauliflower ear from having their neck stood on for so long. I don't think there's going to be any change anytime soon.
Well, Dana White is promising that if you're involved in this, you'll go to prison. Okay.
Prison.
So Dana White ain't screwing around here. Okay. So he's got the FBI, backing him on this whole thing. So, a notable story to, keep your eyes on.
Rich Holland is having some issues too.
He is, but I don't know if any sports books are going to be, taking any wagers on Rich Holland and his futures, yes, either. But
well, anyway, there'll be a TKO earnings report, this evening. And, I expect great financial results. A cash gusher is what TKO is.
Yeah. Do you think they'll break down, the ESPN pool? What portion is going toward performers and talent from this new deal? The $7.7 billion deal with Paramount, what portion of that's going towards the fighters? What amount, Saudi Arabia is contributing to the retirement funds of all these performers? Yes. Do you think any of those questions will be asked?
No.
Okay. Well, everyone, we're at the end of the road. Thank you so much for joining us for another edition of Pollock and Thurston. We're here every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. Hit subscribe on the WrestleNomics and Post Wrestling YouTube channels. I'm going to be back tonight with Wei Ting after Dynamite. We will be live at postwrestlingcafe.com. And then tomorrow we're doing Rewind Away, covering some of the top retirement matches in history. We're going to talk some Terry Funk from 1983. Do you realize it's been over 40 years since Terry Funk retired? His last match, 1983. Never again did we see him. Yeah.
Yes.
We'll be talking all about that
forever.
Brandon is going to be, continuing to design the finest graphics in pro wrestling media over at patreon.com/WrestleNomics, where you can get up to date on everything big data plus panel related, no affiliation to Nielsen, and as well, breakdown of market to market comparisons for WWE and AEW, AEW's third quarter, key performance indicators, and I'm sure plenty of coverage coming out of tonight's earnings call slash chest thumping that is going to take place on tonight's call.
Yes, we're planning live coverage at WrestleNomics.com from Jason Presser.
I like the sound of that.
Well, Mark Shapiro will be leading the way.
I can't wait.
Okay.
And I can't wait to hear the canned comments from Ari Emanuel that were pre-recorded.
Thank you, everybody. Great quarter. We anticipated EBITDA increase of 12%, which is marginal growth from last quarter. Mark, now over to you. Thank you, Vince. I mean, Ari. All right, everyone. We are going to sign off. Thanks to everyone for checking us out, and we'll be back next Wednesday.